I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Larry Hogan has been Maryland's governor just over a month, and today we'll assess how he's doing so far. Last month, the governor blocked new environmental regulations to curtail the widespread use of poultry manure as fertilizer on Eastern Shore farms. Hogan said the rules, put in place by the O'Malley administration to reduce pollution into the Chesapeake Bay, would decimate farming. Yesterday, the governor unveiled his own set of rules, though it's unclear how different they are from O'Malley's. We'll hear more about that in the hour ahead as Chris Connolly, WYPR's Statehouse reporter, joins us from Annapolis, along with C. Fraser Smith, WYPR news analyst, and Republican blogger Richard Cross III. Midday Maryland politics after the news. Hey, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Nice of you to join us. Glad you could join us here on WYPR. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Open phone lines this hour as we talk some politics, talk about state government, city government. Governor Larry Hogan has been Maryland governor now for about a month and a couple of days since his inauguration last month, January 21st. So we thought we'd talk about what's been going on in Annapolis during this hour with the governor, the state budget, and various other pieces of legislation coming through the General Assembly, which is now about halfway through its 90-day session. Chris Connolly, WYPR's Statehouse reporter, will be joining us in a few minutes to give us an update on things at the Statehouse. C. Fraser Smith, WYPR senior news analyst, is with me in the studio today, I'm happy to say. Fraser, nice to see you.
Good to be with you, Dan.
We're both, Fraser's wearing an extra sweater. I've got my scarf on. I don't know what it is. The studio is particularly cold. I guess everything is cold
today.
We're
taking care of the machinery, Dan. it has nothing to do with us.
Is that what it is? Keeping the computers cool?
That's it.
They're extra cool. Everything is extra cool today in Baltimore. Anyway, wherever you are, I hope you're warm. And thanks for joining us here on Midday. If you have something to say at any point during this hour, as I say, please give us a ring. 410-662-8780. We invited Richard Cross III on the show, Republican blogger, and he's been on Midday before. Richard, nice to have you back with us.
Good to be here.
You know, Richard worked for the last Republican governor, Bob Ehrlich. He was a speechwriter, press secretary, was on Capitol Hill and in Annapolis. So I'd like to get your reflections on Larry Hogan so far. He's been in office only about a month. Maybe there isn't too much we can say in terms of what his success will be. But we can certainly talk about what he's proposed and what he had to say in his state of the state, because I haven't had a chance actually to speak to either of you about the governor's state of the state address back in early part of this month. So let me start with Richard, and maybe looking at this comparatively speaking with the Ehrlich administration, the early days of that. What do you think so far?
Well, I was thinking about that this morning, and I think the big difference between the two Republican governors is the experience they brought with them into office. Governor Ehrlich came into office as a legislator who had been a legislator in Annapolis, so I think he had expectations of collegiality among his former colleagues that never actually materialized. Larry Hogan served in the Ehrlich administration. I got to know him a little bit. He has more of an executive background. He brought those executive skills into office, but also he brought the experiences of the Ehrlich administration. So I think the big difference you see among them is I think you have more of a penchant for Larry Hogan to compromise, whereas with Governor Ehrlich, he was more inclined just to say no. And to illustrate that point, I would point to the regulations that were announced regarding pollution on farms. It seems like Larry Hogan really is trying to not just say no to the environmentalist, he's trying to come back with his own ideas.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Richard, because it's top of mind for Fraser and I. And maybe we ought to go right there, Fraser. We can talk about the state of the state later. But farm runoff rules issued by Hogan administration, lead story in The Sun today and The Washington Post. This is the governor who said in December before he took office that he would not allow these rules to put you out of business, speaking to farmers, destroy your way of life, or decimate your entire industry. My first fight will be against these politically motivated midnight hour phosphorus management tool regulations that the outgoing administration, meaning the O'Malley administration, is trying to force upon you in these closing days. That was Larry Hogan in December speaking to the Maryland Farm Bureau's annual convention in Ocean City. Now we've seen that he's come back with his own rules. And Richard, Frazier and I were looking at this just based on the news stories, and it's hard to see much of a difference here. Go ahead, Frazier. I'll let you in on this.
Well, the regulations were issued, as he says, in a way that could be characterized by him anyway as midnight hour, right. You know, right near the end of his—
Of the O'Malley administration.
But the fact is that these regulations have been discussed and debated and vetted over many years, probably a decade. So the idea that nobody was paying attention to the problem has obviously come clear to Mr. Hogan. And I think it's a good sign, actually, that he is recognizing that a lot of work has gone into this and that there's not a lot of major tinkering that he can do. I mean, what has he done here, really? He's extended the length of it.
He extended it from 6 to 7 years for implementation of the rules regarding the use of poultry manure to fertilize farm fields on the eastern shore of Maryland. Richard, back to you on that then. This looks like face-saving, maybe, but it also looks like a willingness to recognize there is an environmental movement. Maybe he can be a green Republican governor.
Well, I think it looks like him, again, reaching out to kind of non-traditional constituencies for Republican in a way that Ehrlich didn't. I mean, the comments by the environmental community in the Sun article, I think they were guardedly positive. And I think on the other end of it, it's an attempt to show that he's responsive to one of his core constituencies, the agricultural community on the Eastern Shore. So I think politically it seems to have been a rather kind of astute maneuver. People can debate the policy differences, but politically it looks like he'd really kind of put some thought into this.
Richard, what did you think of the State of the State address? Let's go back to that. Maybe that's in politics, that's ancient history now, but it was only February 4th, I think. And the reaction to that really surprised a lot of people. I mean, there was some kind of harsh words from Democrats about the tone of that speech.
Well, I have a lot to say about that. But let me, let me let you know, in full disclosure, I helped him with his inaugural speech. I worked on that speech, and I was very happy to have not played a role in writing the State of the State speech.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll thank you for the disclosure, and sorry about what I said about that speech. But anyway,
It's fine.
Maybe it was in the delivery, Richard.
We can talk about that later.
Okay.
But about the State of the State speech, what I honestly think happened, and based on kind of conversations I had with his people, I don't think it was on anyone's radar screen. And if you look at the draft of it, it seems like a pastiche of old campaign rhetoric. And some of the material from the state from the inaugural speech. So I think that they had to kind of pull together a speech quickly and use what they had. And it resulted in the fact that the speech was probably more suited in terms of its tone to a Lincoln Day dinner than to the legislature.
Well, I think two things about that speech. I think Mr. Hogan had spent the previous year saying pretty much what he said that day,
yeah,
with no pushback.
Right.
And suddenly he's standing there in front of people, most of whom are Democrats, who feel a good deal of pride in the status of the state of Maryland, and they're sitting there listening to somebody trash their work.
In dealing with the budget for the last 8 years.
Right.
Yeah.
On the other hand, to his, defend him just a little for what he did. Now, of course, if they just really just threw it together and didn't think about it, that's one thing. But in fact, he is the new Republican governor of Maryland, and a lot of people voted for him because they accept what he said. So I think he was in between problems here. He needs to deal with the legislature, but he also had to show his bona fides a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And if he instantly backed off, I think the people that supported him have thought, who did we elect here? Is this just not the kind of Republican we thought we'd elected?
When the political scientist Tom Schaller was on the show a few weeks ago, he was talking about the conservative or the liberal echo chambers that exist out in congressional districts. When you're running in a red meat red congressional district or a very blue congressional district, you say the things those constituents want to hear. But when you get into a mixed group, such as the state legislature, it doesn't go over so well. You can say actually some outrageous things when you're campaigning in a place where you're trying to be as conservative as possible, as far to the right as possible. But when you come into the mainstream someplace, in the media or whatever, it doesn't always fly. The reaction of that speech, he used that off-quoted Gallup poll that showed 42 or 44% of Marylanders said that they would live someplace else if they could. Had less to do with taxes, it turns out, than it had to do with wanting a different climate or to live where they had grown up or something like that. But anyway, he used that. Jamie Raskin, the Democratic state senator, said of the Hogan speech, well, he started off by saying half the people in Maryland wanted to leave the state, and by the time he was done with the speech, the rest of them wanted to leave as well. But, you know, Mike Miller, the state Senate president, who before the inauguration, Richard, seemed to be, you know, opening a door to Hogan and sitting down with him.
Right.
Of the speech, he said, it's not reality. His speech is fiction. This is the real world. People want to hear the truth. He's also said that most of what Hogan has proposed in terms of the budget will not fly, and tax reductions, you know, halting the automatic increases in the state's gasoline tax, for instance, to cite one example. So I don't know. Does that speech hurt him, or is that gonna? Are we gonna shake the Democrats and politicians in Annapolis shake that off and move on?
Well, I think Mike Miller is a very transactional politician, and I think the speech irritated him and the Democrats. But looking at it a couple weeks later, I don't see where it did any lasting damage. I think a lot of the policy issues that were outlined in the speech is what you could expect from a kind of a center-right Republican candidate for governor who ran on those issues openly. And I think the debate from here on out is going to be focused on those issues, you know, the rain tax and so forth, and the tone of the speech, which I think was more of a lost opportunity than kind of a longstanding damage. It will, I think, be forgotten as events kind of unfold.
Frazier.
Yeah, he's doing repair work even now. I mean, with his new phosphorus regulation idea, which I think is not complete, but that's what's going on here. And I think that message will be strong, as you point out, and as you do, Richard. I mean, I think people see that and say, oh, this is a guy that we can work with.
410-662-8780 is our phone number here. It's Midday Politics. Dan Rodericks with Frazier Smith, who's going to be with us for the hour, the senior news analyst here at WYPR and Daily Record columnist. And Richard Cross III, thank you very much for joining us today. One last thing from you. If we look at these proposals, which I guess we should talk about some more, I mentioned halting the automatic increases in the state's gasoline tax, which is what the legislature put in place a couple of years ago. He proposed a tax exemption, which we'll talk about, for some small businesses, 70,000 small businesses, a property tax exemption, and repealing the stormwater mitigation fee, which the governor derides as a rain tax. What's your prognosis on these things?
I think the gas tax rollback is a non-starter, given the support that the Democrats have shown for it. I think if you look at the recent Washington Post poll, 65% of Marylanders would like the stormwater mitigation fee, also known as the rain tax, rolled back. And I think the other proposal you mentioned is, in terms of its budgetary impact, is relatively modest. So I would say number two and number three have kind of the most prospect of being enacted. I wouldn't put my money on the gas tax.
Okay. Richard, thanks for your time today.
Anytime.
Richard Cross III, who blogs at Cross Purposes, a Republican, and who has served, as I said, with Bob Ehrlich as a speechwriter and press secretary. 410-662-8780 is our number here. It's Midday Politics. Dan Rodericks with Frazier Smith. You can call in and tell us what you think of the governor so far. And 65% of Marylanders want a rollback in the stormwater fee, when it only affects those of us who live in Baltimore City and the nine largest counties. Well, that's interesting. I wonder if they only polled those 10 jurisdictions. I don't know. You can tell us what you think about that as well. 410-662-8780. And these poultry manure regulations that came out today. Not much difference from what the O'Malley administration had proposed. What do you make of that? We're also going to talk about education funding and what's going on here in Baltimore City. So feel free to give us a ring. Chris Conley, the WYPR State House reporter, will be joining us after this short break. And welcome back. This is the Midday Show. Dan Roderick's here with C. Fraser Smith, senior news analyst at WYPR. In just a few minutes, Chris Connolly will be joining us from Annapolis. He covers the General Assembly for WYPR. On that gasoline tax, Fraser, why don't we just explain that to folks for a minute, give us a little bit of background on that. That's an automatic increase in the gasoline tax based on inflation. Is that right? It's a cost adjustment.
I believe that is correct. My thought about it is political.
Okay.
I think he knew that he was dealing with the Democratic Assembly that had an investment in this, and it was going to go nowhere. But from his point of view, in a sense, it was a free shot for him because he can make his political point about it and not lose the revenue, which he is definitely going to need because he's talking about doing a lot of work on highways.
Yeah.
And if you're not replenishing the trust fund, that's been the problem with that fund. You know, there was borrowing from it, which people didn't like. In fact, it just kept the O'Malley administration from raising taxes more or laying a lot of people off. That's why they did what they did.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he can be against it. I mean, it's a great situation in a way for him. He can be against it and make, you know, the points about tax reduction and still have the money to do the other work he wants to do.
Yeah, you just jarred my memory on this. This goes back a couple of years, as I said, when they did a sort of sweeping overhaul of the transportation. They had a big bill that went through Annapolis that included the gasoline tax, but also called for these big projects to take place in a couple of years, right?
Yeah.
And that's why they put the automatic increase in there.
Well, and one of the issues of the campaign.
It's a small automatic increase, I might say.
Yeah. One of the issues in the campaign was the lockbox issue so that people don't rate it anymore. And the other thing about the timing, I think, that people have pointed out is that why not let it stand right now while gas prices are low?
Right. And there's also a call to raise the tax on the federal level, too. There was a story out in the paper this past weekend about the states scrambling a bit because of the lack of federal funds or decline in federal funds coming to the states for highways.
Well, and you know, the broader point, Dan, is that the country and obviously the city of Baltimore need a lot of money for infrastructure repair, and people are going to have to pay for that. They hate it. They don't want it, but they're going to have to do it, or else, you know, their cars are not going to make it through the winter.
410-662-8780 is our phone number for Midday if you'd like to join us here. Chris Connolly now joining us again from Annapolis. Chris covers the legislature for WYPR. Chris, thanks for hooking up today.
Sure thing.
So I guess I should start off by asking you about the poultry regulations. So we go back to that topic just for a moment here.
Okay.
You know, Larry Hogan, before he became governor, made a lot of noise about this, saying that it was going to be his first fight to block these regulations that came in toward the end of the O'Malley administration. And then he said, well, I'll come up with my own plan, and he did. And Fraser and I are sitting here reading news accounts and trying to figure out what the difference is, and there doesn't seem to be much other than maybe extending the implementation of these rules another year from 6 to 7.
It's sort of two things. It's definitely delaying the implementation of the rules, but it's also it seems like a more kind of robust monitoring of how this will affect farmers and chicken farmers out on the Eastern Shore. So he's also pledged a little bit of money. He hasn't said how much or where it might come from through MDA, the Maryland Department of Agriculture, to help ameliorate some of the effects of it. But, you know, the details are still a little bit sketchy on this. I think people are still kind of combing through what he's proposing. He hasn't actually put forward what the regulations would look like. So the jury's still kind of out, I think, on exactly how different this is and all the sort of technical specifics here.
One of the costs would come from hauling away chicken manure. Instead of being able to spread it on fields, it needs to go somewhere. One of the things that actually impresses me about the Hogan proposal is that there would be an immediate ban. According to Tim Wheeler's story in The Sun, an immediate ban on spreading poultry manure on some Eastern Shore fields where the water quality threat is greatest. In other words, where it's already saturated, where there's already so much phosphorus in the ground. Right, Chris?
It would. It would ban it on 500
FIV, which I'm going to totally blank on what that means. But basically, the top level of phosphorus in the soil, those farms can't apply any more chicken manure sort of immediately. And Hogan estimated that would be about 20% of farms on the Eastern Shore. And when you talked about this problem of hauling away or somehow dealing with the manure that you can no longer spread on farms, another piece that's in the proposal is funding for, it's called the Animal Waste Technology Grant Fund, which would support the development of new technologies for manure management, things like waste-to-energy programs, basically look for options on how to deal with it. And then they're also going to be looking at sort of what are the existing capabilities of actually hauling the manure away. Where do you put it? Where does it go? How much does that cost farmers to do that?
I'm glad you mentioned that waste-to-energy technology. One of the possibilities there's a pot of money, several million dollars, sitting around from the state's agreement with Exelon Corporation over the merger with Constellation Energy to build a waste-to-energy incinerator somewhere on the Eastern Shore. And I don't know where that is. It's sort of in the limbo stage. But that would become a very interesting fight, too, because I can tell you from emails I've already received from environmental groups, they're not too happy about the idea of an incinerator burning animal waste, even though it would convert it to energy. That's down the road.
It has the appeal of sounding like a very kind of green, kind of renewable way to get energy. There is the question of exactly what the carbon footprint is once you start burning the manure, if that's really going to be much better, if that's just sort of a convenient way to get rid of it.
Chris, I want to talk with you and Fraser a bit now about curbing the planned increases in education spending in the state, and Baltimore and the other jurisdictions all looking at a shortage of what they had anticipated in terms of funding from the state. And some other things related to this. In Baltimore City, specifically, the school department, the school board discovering a $60 million deficit in its budget, members of the city council expressing shock that this would happen. So let's go over this, Fraser. First, there's a couple of things. First, there's the state funding formula that's been in place for a long time that is apparently coming back to bite Baltimore in particular a bit. Let's talk about that.
Well, the issue there is what happens when you get richer than you used to be, which has happened to Baltimore. And
property values have gone up, and that's part of the formula.
And
right?
the new property that's been built along the waterfront, and the fact that the city has granted tax abatements for 25 years for a lot of this property, so it hasn't actually gone on the tax rolls, and so the city doesn't get a lot of money. But on paper, we're richer than we used to be. And so the formula says you get less money than you used to get because you're richer. But
right.
In fact, it's paper wealth. It doesn't really help us a lot. And I think the question that people in Annapolis are going to ask is, didn't you know this was coming when you did this? And of course, you may want to go ahead and develop. Of course you do. But in the meantime, what are you going to do about the fact that you're getting less money from the state?
And Chris, I would think this would make members of the legislature even less sympathetic to a Baltimore City when they look at that. And then they look at this other problem, the $60 million deficit that the school department's running.
Yeah, and you saw a call from Baltimore lawmakers saying we should change the formula. Maybe this isn't the best way to allocate money. And I think you're right. I do think that for those outside of Baltimore, it sort of sounds like, well, if you guys didn't tax these developments and you can't handle your money, then why should we figure out a way to get you more money? I will say, though, that doesn't go against the overall sort of sense of urgency among a lot of Democratic lawmakers to say that they want to see money put back into the budget that would have gone to schools that was cut in Hogan's proposed budget. So, I don't think that Baltimore City is getting a lot of necessarily sympathy because they're not sort of taxing big developments or handling money very well. But, that doesn't undermine the overall call for restoring some of the education cuts in Hogan's budget.
Right. And we heard those vows from the Speaker of the House and the Senate President, right?
Certainly.
Yeah.
So, Frazier, but the story in here about the formula, the funding formula, this grates on people. Baltimore looks wealthier than it actually is. Developers have enjoyed pretty big, sizable tax breaks from the city over the years, over the last 20 to 25 years in particular. But is anything going to change about that?
Well, things have already changed in terms of the financing for big developments such as we have. There's no federal money anymore for projects like this. The city is running an annual deficit of, you know, who knows of how much it'll be this year given the school's problems, but it's been more than $100 million a year. So the only way that you're going to make these projects work is through the tax system. And I mean, I think people like Jay Brody, who used to do this, who did it for years, who saw all the changes that went on, says you just aren't going to have these projects unless you try to create, as they used to say.
They don't happen without tax breaks.
You're essentially creating money via the tax system.
Right.
And without it, you're just going to get nothing.
Well, in a sense, you're paying developers to build buildings.
Well,
no?
Sure.
Would
well,
you say?
Well, you are, and you know, there are all kinds of things that come along with it. You hope sometimes jobs, sometimes new housing, the active life of the city. It's difficult to manage. You know, there's one major property owner in the city who owns a baseball team who's very unhappy about what's going on in that part of downtown because there's not a corresponding thing going on where a lot of his property. I mean, you know, we're talking about Peter Angelos here.
Right.
And, you know, this is not something that makes him happy. So there's a real balancing act that has to go on.
But in terms of what we're talking about, the formula that the state came up with, this complex formula for school funding, state aid to local jurisdictions for their schools, based on the property values. When you think about it, didn't anybody plan for this? That's a good question. I know that the city council was warned that it could happen.
Well, you know, you think of bureaucrats as faceless gnomes over here, you know, filling or checking the boxes. But we know over time there have been brilliant people doing that work, and I assume that they still are. So something happened here. Something fell through the cracks because they should have known.
Hey, Chris Connolly, I want to hear from you. What else is going on in Annapolis? I said to Chris earlier today, I said, is there something else we should keep our eye on here? We can talk about the stormwater mitigation. Maybe you want to talk about that for a minute, the so-called rain tax. Larry Hogan has proposed repealing it and letting the local jurisdictions do their own thing to comply with the Environmental Protection Agency.
Yeah, I mean, the stormwater remediation fee basically is a law that's from the legislature that they passed a while back that says, you know, that counties, the 10 largest jurisdictions, so Baltimore City and 9 of the biggest counties, have to levy a fee on buildings based on the amount of impervious surfaces, things like driveways, parking lots, that kind of thing, because stormwater that runs off when it rains, you know, has all kinds of chemicals and muck and trash and goes eventually into the bay. It's part of a federal mandate for the state to clean up the Chesapeake Bay. Of course, it has been much maligned. It's called the rain tax by Republicans, and Hogan basically campaigned saying, I want to get rid of this. He said again in his State of the Union he wants to get rid of it, and he said a couple of weeks ago, I'm getting rid of this. He basically wants to strike it from the books. He says, you know, basically his argument is that it should be up to counties to figure out how to pay for these efforts. You have already some counties bucking the system. Carroll County has done away with any kind of a tax or a fee. They're basically paying for their contribution to stormwater remediation through their general fund. You have Frederick County sort of following the law, but just barely, and they have a 1 cent fee, and then they're getting the rest of the cost out of their budget. So states or counties already are kind of doing away with it if they want to. This would basically just say, you know, take the mandate of having a stormwater remediation fee out and let the counties figure out how to contribute their piece to remediating the bay.
Frazier, the reason the legislature went ahead and authorized this fee in the city and the nine largest jurisdictions is because not enough was being done in the local jurisdictions on their own.
That's definitely the case, and it, not just a judgment in Annapolis, but again, by the, as a result of the rules and regulations that the federal government imposed.
And then there's this question, okay, if you let the local jurisdictions you go do it themselves, then you're going back to where you were a couple of years ago, where you know maybe they will, maybe they won't comply. Who's going to enforce it? Is the Maryland Department of the Environment under Larry Hogan going to enforce and check to see what the counties are doing? Is the EPA going to enforce or demand compliance? How does this work after this? If you just repeal that law, does anyone know, either Chris or Frazier?
I believe that it would fall on the state to figure it out. I mean, the federal government basically said, the EPA said, you know, you got to come up with a plan for how you're going to deal with all of these different things going into the bay, and you have to hit certain benchmarks. And they didn't really get into how, they sort of said figure it out. So it would basically fall on the state to continue to figure it out. I mean, the stormwater remediation fee, it should be noted, really came out of a push from counties saying, you know, in some cases, we can't raise, you know, taxes to do this, or, you know, that we don't have the willpower to do it. And so, you know, in some cases, counties were originally pushing for this in the first place, that they force our hands, make us contribute money. And, you know, of course, the big fear from environmentalists is also that, you know, not only sort of have we been down this road before, we've you know, left it up to counties to figure it out, and in some cases, they didn't. But, you know, when you leave it up to a county who says, we don't want to do this through a tax or a fee, we want to do it through the operating budget, you know, we have a surplus now, what happens when they don't have a surplus? And I think it does fall to MDE. I'm not 100% sure of that, but I believe that it falls to MDE to actually do the enforcement. I'm not sure what sort of mechanisms they have to actually enforce it, though.
Thank you, Chris. Chris, before you go, anything else on the agenda, something you want to bring our attention to?
Oh, well, there's all kinds of things.
Well, I asked you for a couple you wanted to talk about.
What's that?
A couple you wanted to talk about today.
Sure. Well, so one of the issues, you know, we talked a bunch about public education funding. Part of Hogan's big push this year is also for really rewriting the charter school law in the country. He wants to make Maryland a lot more attractive to charter schools. Maryland has one of the strongest charter school laws in the country, or, depending on where you sit on it, the most restrictive charter school laws in the country. And he would basically, you know, overhaul that and make it so that charters could set up more easily, have a little bit more money, have a little bit more leeway when it comes to employment, you know, employees and working with the unions. It's gotten a ton of pushback, of course, from groups like the MSEA, the State Teachers Union, but also Democrats are really kind of pushing back and saying, you know, this is an issue that we might be willing to talk about and open up and do some compromising on, but, you know, not when we're taking $144 million out of public education funding. Sort of, you know, we'll work with you on education stuff, but you got to work with us to figure out how to get some of the funding back to schools in the first place. So that's one issue. That'll get a hearing this week. Another one, fracking, there's an interesting bill here that I think is just sort of fascinating, from Senator Bobby Zirkin, the Baltimore County Democrat, who in the past has proposed bans on fracking that have kind of died in committee, gone nowhere. So he's out with a bill this year that, is interesting in its gamesmanship. Basically what it does is, puts an a high liability on companies that would do hydraulic fracturing, to say that they're liable for a couple of decades and to the, you know, for any damages that occur to the environment, to people's well water, et cetera, in the area where they've fracked. But basically says that the standard that they have to meet is they have to prove that they didn't contribute to any kind of harm that comes to the neighborhood. Where they've been fracking. So it's essentially a sort of end run around banning fracking. You know, he doesn't say it quite like that. He says, you know, if it is a deterrent from companies to want to come into Maryland and frack, you know, kind of, so be it. And it's, he's navigating it through his own committee, through the judicial
proceedings,
the Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee, mm-hmm. which he happens to chair. So I think that's kind of an interesting one that's also coming up for a hearing.
Very interesting. It reminds me that we need to catch up with Garrett County and Allegheny County and hear more about what's going on out there in terms of public support or opposition to fracking, because that's where the Marcellus Shale is. That's where it would take place.
Yep,
Chris,
definitely.
Hey, thanks. That's very interesting. Thank you very much for being on the show again today.
Of course.
Chris Conley, yeah, listen for his reports on WYPR from the news staff here who covers the State House for the station. 410-662-8780 is our phone number. Open phone lines. Dan Roderick's here with C. Fraser Smith as we talk some Maryland politics in this hour. The stormwater fee, Governor Hogan's new rules on pollution, farm pollution, very similar to the rules we saw from the O'Malley administration after a lot of bellowing about how bad that would be, how bad the impact would be on farmers. And members of the Baltimore City Council expressing shock that the schools face a shortfall next year of more than $60 million. What do you think of that? 410-662-8780. A short break. We'll be right back. You know, after the story came out in The Sun about Baltimore's total property value going up, right, $1.3 billion or something like that, and how that affected the state's education funding formula, right, that the city actually looked richer than it was because of a lot of tax breaks that had been given specifically to developers in fabulous places along the waterfront, for instance, over the last, we're talking about a 20-year period, 25, this goes back to the 90s, early 90s with Mayor Schmoke. And then we saw these tax breaks through the O'Malley administration, Dixon administration, and under the present mayor. And when the present mayor was here, she tried to say that tax breaks for waterfront development, redevelopment, had nothing to do with the funding formula. And I can't even explain her explanation. I'd have to sit down, read it all, listen to it again.
Well, the explanation
and try to write it.
It was an error. She was wrong about what she was saying there. Yeah, one thing she said
was,
I need
to put all that together for our listeners so they understand it. So anyway, no, go ahead.
I mean, she said that a lot of this new development was not in a taxing zone.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, she just may have, confused different
assessments are made in three stages over 3 years, and she was trying to say that the assessment of the waterfront was not included in this particular year. She said that this was a blip and it wouldn't happen again, yeah. But it's gonna cost the city schools millions of dollars, and the taxable base, though, Fraser, my point is the taxable base, is it not?
Well,
it's not just a piece of it; it's the whole thing.
It goes back to what I was trying to say earlier. When Schaefer was the mayor, they did not do this. Their idea was, you need to get all of this new property on the tax rolls. That's the reason you want to develop. But it has gotten to a point where you can't do the work unless you do use the tax code.
Right.
And so that's what's going on.
Let's take some calls on this and other topics. 410-662-8780. Catherine in Baltimore, thank you for calling Midday.
Hi, I'm calling about the rainwater tax.
Mm-hmm.
And I am opposed to the idea that this is only to prevent rainwater from going into the Chesapeake Bay. I moved to Baltimore County in 2005, and within 11 months of moving here, it rained really hard one day, about 8 inches in 10 hours, and came home to find that the Baltimore County sewer system had vomited in my shower stall in the basement. And since then, I've done door-to-door surveys of neighborhoods like mine and found that this is happening all over the place every time it rains. And it should not be that this happens, except that some of these sewer lines are 80 or 100 years old. They're made out of terracotta, clay pipes, and the sewer lines are run down the same storm sewer as the rainwater. So as those sewer lines deteriorate and more houses are built in neighborhoods, then there's a higher demand on the sewage capacity, which it can't accept, and the stormwater then seeps into the cracks in the sewer lines, and people's houses fill up. I know people who put beach balls in their toilets and jam a 2x4 up against the ceiling to hold the beach ball in the toilets in their basement so that sewage doesn't come into their houses when it rains. And I don't live in a low-class neighborhood. I live in a middle-class neighborhood, but this is happening everywhere.
Well, fortunately, what you're describing, yeah, as and we did a whole show on this, is that, you know, Baltimore's system, Baltimore County's system, is old and has been overloaded. And when there's flooding, when there's big rains, it does, as Catherine says, it all washes together. Now, there is a $1 or $2 billion upgrade that's going on now. It's been going on for a while. That is paid for with a combination of state and federal funds. And that's separate from the stormwater fee. So the stormwater fee was put in place to deal with the filthy stormwater that runs off of driveways and parking lots and lawns into the gutters and out into the harbor and into the Chesapeake Bay. So that's there for a different, that's a fee, and it's not a tax, and it's a, I mean, they call it a fee, and it's not a tax. It is a fee that the counties and the city gets to levy based on a formula they come up with.
Well, it's like somebody said in a campaign ad that people still quote, if it came out of my pocket, it's a tax.
Yeah, right. Russ in Darlington, Maryland, in Harford County says, I have not heard politicians that wish to repeal the stormwater remediation fee actually discuss the problem underlying the fee's implementation. Do they not agree that there is a problem? Do they not feel this fee actually solves or addresses the problem? Yeah, that's what I can't. They all seem to think, those who are opposed to it, Barry Glassman, the Harford County executive, for instance, thinks they can just take it out of their general fund and deal with it, that they don't have to. And they only had a $12.50 per household fee in Harford County. $12.50. You tell me they can't put $12.50 per household to good use in Harford County in dealing with stormwater, building, you know, ponds that catch it, rain gardens, whatever it takes, better systems for dealing with that water? I don't know. Let's go to Zachary in Hereford up in Baltimore County. Hi, Zach.
Hi, thanks for having me on your show. Just as a quick side note, I'd like to say that the rainwater tax, getting rid of that is going to be a race to the bottom. But I wanted to go back to a different issue.
Sure.
The thing that I'm worried about is how we got the Exelon bid. I know some of your guests talked about how Baltimore now seems richer than it is, but I think that the reason why that is because of the TIF. So I was hoping some of your guests could explain what the tax incremental financing system is, how it works. And I'll take my answer.
Oh my God. We're both shaking our heads here. You want us to explain what a TIF is? I can't do that. I have to go read that before I would say a word about it on the air here. But it's another way of deferring taxes, providing some exemption for developers. Sorry, can't help you with that one, Zachary. If someone wants to Google quickly what a TIF is, I will read it on the air, because as a reporter, Fraser, you're sitting there nodding. If you go write a column about this, you have to go refresh your memory every time, or call somebody up, Jay Brody or somebody, and ask them what exactly this is and how does it work. 410-662, you agree with me?
Absolutely.
Don't let me sit here saying I didn't know the answer to something by myself.
No, I mean, you know, Dan, look, we both know that being a reporter is a lifelong adult education course. But if you didn't take the course yesterday, you may not remember the details, and that would be my story.
I have to go back each time. Payment in lieu of taxes. Now, that one's easier to understand. That's a pilot. That's what Mr. Patarakis got years ago in the 1990s when Kurt Schmoak was mayor. And the city needed a new convention center hotel. Remember all this? The city needed a convention center hotel because the convention center downtown had just been expanded. And they were looking over toward Mr. Angelos's territory there on the west side of downtown, over toward Camden Yards, which is where the expanded convention center was, right? But instead, they agreed to support Mr. Patarakis's hotel on the far side, a mile away from the convention center, over in Harbor East. And he got a pilot, a payment in lieu of taxes.
Well, you know,
he doesn't pay very much. I think he paid $1 a year or something.
One of the things that we're seeing here is that you think you and I can't explain, and you're right, but imagine what's happening in the new administration in Annapolis. They are facing, you know, what's the image? You know, you're trying to have a drink of water out of a fire hose. I mean, you know, they're really swamped. What I hear from down there is that those folks are really just trying to make it through the year while they're on this, you know, an immediate learning curve that is quite steep.
On TIFFs, by the way, I'll go back to that for a moment if you want, because Barry Raskovar, a colleague from Political Maryland, had a piece about Baltimore's self-inflicted wound. That was what he called it, referring to all these tax breaks and coming back to bite Baltimore because of the school funding formula and the shortage there. He says, favored investors under four mayors, and he mentions Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake, Mayor Kurt Schmoke, Martin O'Malley, Sheila Dixon, they all got carried away with a tax avoidance scheme. That's what he calls it. These favored investors are allowed to make payments in lieu of taxes, pilots, and are given tax increment financing deals, and this is what Barry says, that divert their property tax payments into public improvements for their developments. It is something like that. That is something like what Michael Beatty will be doing with the Harbor Point development downtown.
Nobody wants to trust a developer, right? They're the bad guys on the block. Hmm. But when you've got somebody like Jay Brody, who I think is a very trustworthy public servant for many years, mm-hmm. standing up and saying, look, you can have development or not have it. If you don't want it, then you're going to have to subsidize it because there just isn't the money to do it.
Hey, Dane and Glenarm, I'm going to put you on here. You can tell us what your issue is, and then we'll look that up for you. Go right ahead, Dane. What's up?
Well, you know, first of all, I love your show. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I really appreciate it. I am a health insurance broker here in Maryland, and there was a bill brought to the Senate by Senator Middleton this week that's going to negatively affect small business owners here in Maryland. And can't imagine what the motivation is for bringing this bill to the table, frankly.
Can you just tell us briefly what it is?
Sure. So it's Bill 703. Basically, what it's going to do is it's going to make what's called a partially self-funded health insurance plan too expensive for small business owners. And small business owners in Maryland have already been squeezed a bit by the Affordable Care Act and some of the new rating methodology. And this has been a great way. In fact, three of my clients were only able to continue coverage for their employees by going with a partially self-funded plan.
Dane, would you do me a favor?
Uh-huh.
I'm gonna give you my email address here on the air, and I'd like could you write me a note about this?
Absolutely.
And remind me. And if I don't get to it, I'll give it to someone in the Baltimore Sun, the business department, to take a look at this.
I guess my point is, you know, that these small business owners need more choices, not less.
Hmm.
And I don't think that the spirit of the Affordable Care Act was to give people less choices. And I don't think that this follows the spirit of the law.
All right, Dan, we'll take a look at it. It's drodricks@baltsun.com. Drodricks, R-O-D-R-I-C-K-S, at baltsun.com. That's the best way to reach me at the Sun. You can reach me here at drodricks@wypr.org. It's fsmith@wypr.org for Fraser Smith, WYPR senior news analyst. Thank you again for sitting in with me for an hour here.
My pleasure, Dan.
Yeah, nice to have you on the show, Frazier. Thank you, everybody, for tuning into our first hour. Please stay tuned. We've got a great hour coming up for you in hour two, as Scott Stossel will be joining us from The Atlantic Magazine to talk about his book, My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. We're going to take a break here and get some lunch from Bagby Pizza Company, located in the historic Bagby Building near Harbor East. Thank you very much, Bagby, for providing lunch for our guests.